She knew she would have his complete attention again with her next statement, and she delayed the moment. It was too sweet to waste. She wanted to draw every last possible enjoyment from it. It was double pleasure. Her revenge on Daniel Armstrong, and her offering to Ephraim Tafari, which would prove to him her loyalty and her worth. "What is it?" he repeated. He took a handful of her hair and twisted it just hard enough to hurt. He was a master at inflicting pain, and her breath caught with masochistic pleasure. "I am telling you this to show you how completely I am yours, how much I love you," she whispered. "After tonight you will never be able to doubt where my loyalties lie." He chuckled and shook her head gently from side to side, his fingers still locked in her hair, still hurting exquisitely. "Let me be the judge of that, my little red lily. Tell me this terrible thing." "It is a terrible thing, Ephraim. On the instructions of Daniel Armstrong, I filmed the forced removal of the villagers from Fish Eagle Bay to make way for the new casino." Ephraim Tafari stopped breathing. For 20 beats of his heart under her ear, he held his breath. Then he let it out softly, and his pulse rate was slightly elevated, as he said quietly, "I don't know what you are talking about. Explain this to me." "Daniel and I were on top of a cliff when the soldiers came to the village. Daniel ordered me to film them."
"And what did you see?"
"We saw them bulldoze the village and burn the boats. We saw them load the people into the trucks and take them away." She hesitated.
"Go on," he ordered. "What else did you see?"
"We saw them kill two people. They clubbed an old man to death and they shot another when he tried to escape. They threw their bodies on the fire."
"You filmed all that?" Ephraim asked.
And there was something in his tone that made her suddenly uncertain and afraid. "Daniel forced me to film it."
"I do not know anything about these events, this atrocity. I gave no orders," he said.
And with a surge of relief, she believed him. "I was sure you didn't know about it."
"I must see this film. It is evidence against those who perpetrated this atrocity. Where is the film?"
"I gave it to Daniel."
"What did he do with it?" Ephraim demanded,
and now his voice was terrible. "He said that he had lodged it with the British Embassy in Kahali. The ambassador, Sir Michael Hargreave, is an old friend of his."
"Did he show the film to the ambassador?" Ephraim wanted to know.
"I don't think so. He said that it was dynamite, that he wouldn't use it until the time was ripe."
"So you and Armstrong are the only ones who know about it, who know that the film exists."
She hadn't thought of it that way, and now it gave her an uneasy feeling. "Yes, I suppose so. Unless Daniel has told anybody. I haven't."
"Good." Ephraim released her hair and stroked her cheek. "You are a good girl. I am grateful to you. You have proved your friendship to me."
"It's more than friendship, Ephraim. I have never felt about another man the way I feel for you."
"I know," he whispered, and lifted her head and kissed her on the lips. "You are a wonderful woman. My own feelings for you grow stronger all the time."
Gratefully, she pressed her own full body to his sleek feline length.
"We must get that film back from Sir Michael. It could do untold damage to this country and to me as the president."
"I should have told you sooner," she said. "But only now I realize how much I love you."
"It is still not too late," he assured her. "I will speak to Armstrong in the morning. I will give him my word that the guilty persons will be brought to justice. He must give me the film to be used in evidence."
"I don't think he'll do that," she said. "The tape is too sensational. It's worth a million to him. He won't want to give it up."
"Then you will have to help me get it back. After all, it is your film. Will you help me, my beautiful red and white lily?"
"You know I will, Ephraim. I'll do anything for you," she murmured. And without another word, he made love to her, that beautiful, devastating love of which only he was capable. Afterwards she slept. When she awoke, it was raining again. It always seemed to be raining in this terrible green hell of jungle. The rain clattered and drummed on the roof of the VIP guest bungalow, and the darkness was complete. She groped instinctively for Ephraim, but the bed beside her was empty. The sheets on which he had lain were already cool. He must have left her some time ago. She thought he might have gone to the bathroom, and felt the pressure in her own bladder, which had woken her. She lay and listened for him to return, but after 5 minutes, when he had not come, she crept out from under the mosquito net and groped her way through the darkness to the bathroom door. She bumped into a chair and stubbed her bare toe before she reached it. She found the light switch and blinked in the sudden glare of the white tiles. The bathroom was empty, but the toilet seat was raised to prove he had been there before her. She flapped it down and perched naked upon it, still groggy with sleep, her red hair tangled over her eyes. Outside, the rain battered down, and a sudden flare of lightning lit the window. Bonnie reached across to the side wall for the roll of toilet paper in its holder, and her ear was inches from the thin prefabricated partition of the wall of the bungalow. She heard voices, indistinct but masculine, from the room beyond. She was slowly coming fully awake, and her interest was aroused. She pressed her ear to the wall, and she recognised Ephraim's voice. It was crisp and commanding. Somebody answered him, but the sound of the rain intruded, and she could not recognise the speaker. "No," Ephraim replied. "Tonight I want it done immediately." Bonnie was fully alert now, and at that moment the rain stopped with dramatic suddenness. In the silence she heard the reply and recognised the speaker. "Will you sign a warrant, Mr. President?" It was Chetty Singh. His accent was unmistakable. "Your soldiers could carry out the execution." "Don't be a fool, man. I want it done quietly. Just get rid of him. You can get Kajo to help you, but do it. No questions, no written records. Just get rid of him."
"Ah, yes, I understand. We will say that he went to film in the jungle. Later we can send a search party to find no trace of him. A great pity. But what about the woman? She is also a witness to our arrangements at Fish Eagle Bay. Do you want me to take care of her at the same time?"
"No, don't be an idiot. I will need her to recover the tape from the embassy. Afterwards, when the tape is safely in my hands, I will reconsider the problem of the woman. In the meantime, just take Armstrong out into the jungle and get rid of him."
"I assure you, Mr. President, that nothing would give me more pleasure. It will take me an hour or so to make the arrangements with Kajo, but it will be all over before daylight. I give you my solemn promise."
There was the sound of a chair being pushed back, and heavy footsteps. Then a door slammed, and there was silence from the sitting room of the bungalow. Bonnie sat frozen for a moment, chilled by what she had heard. Then she sprang to her feet and darted across the floor to the light switch and plunged the bathroom into darkness. Swiftly she groped her way to the bed and crept under the mosquito net. She lay rigid under the sheet, expecting Ephraim Tafari to return at any moment. Her mind was racing. She was frightened and confused. She had not expected any of this. She had thought that Ephraim might seize the videotape and arrest Daniel, then deport him immediately and declare him an undesirable alien or something like that. She hadn't been too clear as to what Ephraim would do to Daniel, but she had never dreamed for a moment that he would have him killed, squashed like an insect without pity or remorse. With a jolt she realised just how naive she had been. The shock was almost too much to bear. She had never hated Daniel. Far from it, she had been as fond of him as she was capable of, until he had begun to bore and irritate her. Of course, after Ephraim had taken over, Daniel had insulted and fired her, but she had given him some reason for that, and she didn't hate him, not to the point of wanting him killed. "Keep out of it," she warned herself. "It's too late now. Danny has to take his own chances." She lay waiting for Ephraim to come back to bed, but he did not come, and she thought of Daniel again. He was one of the few men she had ever genuinely admired and liked. He was decent and good and funny and handsome. She broke that chain of thought. "Don't be a bleeding heart," she thought. "It didn't turn out the way you expected, but that's tough on Danny." And yet there had been a veiled threat to her in what Ephraim had said. "When the tape is safely in my hands, I will reconsider the problem of the woman." Ephraim still hadn't come. She sat up in bed and listened. The rain had stopped completely. Reluctantly, she slipped out from under the mosquito net and picked her robe from the foot of the bed. She crossed to the door that opened onto the veranda of the bungalow and opened it quietly. She crept down the veranda. The light from the sitting room windows beamed out onto the veranda door. She moved into a position from where she could see into the sitting room while remaining in shadow. Ephraim Tafari sat at the desk against the far wall. His back was to her. He was dressed in a khaki T-shirt and camouflage trousers. He was smoking a cigarette and studying the papers that were strewn across the desktop. He seemed to be settled to his work. It would take her less than 10 minutes to reach the row of guest bungalows at the east side of the compound and get back to the bedroom. The wooden catwalks were wet and red with mud. She was barefoot. Daniel might not be in his room. She thought of every excuse for not going to warn him. "I owe him nothing," she thought, and heard Ephraim's voice again in her imagination. "Just take Armstrong out into the jungle and get rid of him." She backed away from the lighted window, not yet certain what she would do, until she found herself running along the catwalk beneath the dark trees that dripped with rain. She slipped and fell on her knees, but jumped up and kept running. There was red mud on the front of her robe. She saw through the trees that there was one light on in the row of guest rooms. The rest of them were in darkness. As she came closer, she saw with relief that the light was in Daniel's room. She did not go up onto the veranda of the guest house, but jumped down off the catwalk and made her way around the back of the building. Daniel's window was curtained. She scratched softly on the mosquito mesh screen that covered it, and at once heard a chair scrape back on the wooden floor. She scratched again, and Daniel's voice asked softly, "Who is it?" "For God's sake, Danny, it's me. I have to talk to you." "Come inside, I'll open the door." "No, no, 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 come out here. It's desperate. They mustn't see me. Hurry. Hurry, man." Half a minute later, his broad-shouldered form loomed out of the darkness, backlit by the lighted bungalow window. "Danny, Ephraim knows about the Fish Eagle Bay tape."
"How did he find out?"
"That doesn't matter."
"You told him, didn't you?"
"Damn you to hell, I have come to warn you. He's issued orders for your immediate execution. Chetty Singh and Keijo are coming for you. They're going to take you into the jungle. They don't want any evidence."
"How do you know this?"
"Don't ask bloody fool questions. Believe me, I know. I can't waste another minute. I've got to get back. He'll find I'm gone."
She turned away, but he seized her. "Thanks, Bonnie," he said. "You're a better person than you think you are. Do you want to make a break for it with me?" She shook her head.
"I'll be all right," she said. "Just get out of here. You've got an hour, tops. Get going."
She pulled out of his grip and hurried away through the trees. He caught one last glimpse of her. The lights from the bungalow transformed her tumbled hair into a roseate halo, and the long white robe made her look like an angel. "Some angel," Daniel muttered, and stood for a full minute in the darkness, deciding what he could do. While there had been only Chetty Singh and Ning Cheng Gong to deal with, he had stood a chance. Like him, they had been constrained by the necessity of working in secrecy. None of them had been able to attack the other openly, but now Chetty Singh had open sanction to kill him, a special presidential license. Daniel grinned as mirthlessly as a wolf. He could expect the Sikh to act swiftly and ruthlessly. Bonnie was right. He had to get out of Sengi Sengi within the next few minutes, before the executioners arrived. From the angle of the building, he threw a quick glance down the veranda and around the compound. All was quiet and dark. He slipped back into his room and lifted his small travel bag down from the cupboard. It contained all his personal documents, passport, airline tickets, credit cards and traveller's checks. Apart from his clothing and toilet bag, there was nothing else of value in the room. He pulled on a light wind cheater and checked that the key of the Land Rover was in his pocket. He extinguished the lights and went out. The Land Rover was parked at the far end of the veranda. He opened the door quietly and threw his bag onto the passenger seat. All the hired VTR equipment was packed into the rear compartment, and there was a selection of basic camping and first aid equipment in the lockers. But there was no weapon of any kind, apart from his old hunting knife. He started the Land Rover. The engine noise seemed excessively loud in the darkness. He did not switch on the headlights, and he let in the clutch gently, keeping the engine revs down. He drove slowly through the darkened compound towards the main gates. He knew that the gates were never closed at night, and that a single guard was on duty there. Daniel was under no illusion as to just how far he was going to get in the Land Rover. There was only one road from Sengi Sengi to the Ubomo River ferry,
and there was a roadblock every 5 miles. A radio call from Sengi Sengi would alert every one of them. The guards would be waiting for him with their fingers on the triggers of their AK-47s. No, he'd be lucky to make it through the first block, and then he would have to take to the jungle. He didn't relish that prospect. He had been trained for survival and warfare in the drier bushveld of Rhodesia, a long way further south. He would not be nearly as adept in the rainforest, but there was no other way open to him. The first thing was to get clear of Sengi Sengi. After that, he would face each problem as it arose. And this is number one, he thought grimly, as suddenly the floodlights at the main gate switched on in a bright halogen dawn. The entire compound was brightly lit. There were half a dozen figures running from the barrack area where guards were quartered. It was obvious they had dressed hastily. Some were in undervests and shorts. Daniel recognized both Captain Cajo and Chetty Singh. Cajo was brandishing an automatic pistol, and Chetty Singh was trotting along behind him, shouting and waving at the approaching Land Rover, his white turban very visible in the glare of the floodlights. One of the guards was trying to shut the gates. He already had one wing of the steel-framed mesh gate half across the roadway. Daniel switched on his headlights, put his hand flat on the horn and drove hard at him, the hooter blaring. The guard dived nimbly aside, and the Land Rover slammed into the unlocked leaf of the gate and whipped it aside. He roared through. Behind him he heard the rattling clamour of automatic rifle fire. He felt half a dozen bullets slam into the aluminium bodywork of the Land Rover, but he crouched low over the wheel and kept his foot hard down on the accelerator. The first bend in the roadway rushed towards him in the headlights. Another burst of automatic fire splattered against the rear of the vehicle. The rear window exploded in a storm of glass splinters, and something struck him high in the back, within an inch of his spine. He had been hit by a bullet before in that long-ago war, and he recognized the sensation. From the position of the wound, high and close to the spine, it had to be a lung shot, a mortal wound. He expected to feel the choking flood of arterial blood into his lungs. "Keep going as long as you can," he thought, and swung the Land Rover into the bend at full throttle. He went up on two wheels but didn't roll. When he glanced in the rearview mirror, the camp lights were obscured by forest trees, a dwindling glow in the darkness behind. He could feel hot blood running down his back, but there was no choking, no weakness, not yet anyway. The wound was numb. He could think clearly. He could keep going. He knew exactly where the first roadblock was situated. Approximately 5 miles ahead, he reminded himself, on the first river crossing. He tried to remember how the road ran to reach it. He had driven over it half a dozen times during the last 3 days filming. He could remember almost every twist, every track that led off it. He made his decision. He leaned back against the seat. The wound stabbed him like a knife in the back, but he wasn't losing much blood. Internal bleeding, he thought. You aren't going to walk away from this one, Danny boy. But he kept going, waiting for the weakness to overcome him. There were 5 logging roads branching off from the main highway before it reached the first roadblock. Some of them were disused and overgrown, but at least 2 were still being subjected to heavy daily traffic. He chose the first of these, 2 miles from Sengi Sengi, and turned onto it, heading westwards. The Zaire border was 90 miles in that direction, but the logging track only ran 5 miles through the forest before it intersected the Momu excavation. He would have to dump the Land Rover and try to make the remaining 80 miles on foot through uncharted forest. The last part of the journey would be over high mountains, glaciers, and alpine snowfields. Then he thought about the bullet wound in his back and knew he was dreaming. He wasn't going to get that far. The logging track he was on had been deeply rutted and chopped up by the gigantic treaded tires of the trucks and heavy trailers. It was a morass of mud, the consistency and colour of feces, and the Land Rover churned through it in four-wheel drive, pounding through the knee-deep ruts. Flying mud stuck to the glass of the headlights and dimmed the beams to a murky glow that barely lit the roadway 20 paces ahead. The wound in his back was beginning to ache, but his head was still clear. He touched the end of his own nose with his forefinger to check his coordination. No sign of losing it yet. Suddenly he was aware of lights far ahead of him on the track. One of the logging trucks was coming towards him, and instantly he realized the possibility it offered. He slowed the Land Rover and searched the verge of unbroken jungle that pressed in upon the track. He sensed rather than saw a break in the foliage, and swung the Land Rover boldly into it.